Hi guys, welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood, from drragnar.com and Chloe Archard on the line from paleobritain.co.uk. Just to quickly start out, anybody who's still with us after the disaster that was the audio quality on our last podcast, we just have to apologise very much. Somebody's microphone had a bit of a problem. So thank you if you listened to that, or we understand if you didn't listen to all of that, but thank you for listening again. Today we're going to talk about fish. So we were originally going to talk about meat and fish, but then Chloe, as usual, came up with so many questions that we decided just to focus on fish this time, and we'll talk about meat at a later date. So hi, Chloe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So yeah, we're going to talk about fish for sort of 45 minutes to an hour, which hopefully that's something that other people are interested in, not just us. I have got my geek jumper on because I did think it was a bit of a geeky topic to talk about for quite a long time. But there are a lot of things that to discuss that actually are quite interesting. So I'll just go straight into questions.
Great.
So one of the first questions I had was just about sort of our evolutionary history with eating meat. Eating fish. What evidence is there that we evolved eating fish or seafood? And did this have anything to do with the development of our brains?
So that's definitely one of the theories. And I think the fish consumption and meat consumption are actually quite tightly linked, because we know that maybe around 2 million years ago, our brains started to expand. And with that, we had an increase in social behavior, an increase in intelligence. And that's partly, or what we think, what enabled us to migrate out of the plains of Africa, which is where, you know, we think we as a species began. From about that time, about 2 million years ago, we have some evidence of hunting large animals or medium-sized animals, sort of bovine-type animals, I guess something similar to a buffalo. And we particularly eat the insides of the bones for fat, but then the brains. And we think that eating the brains of other animals and increasing our DHA, so DHA is a very important omega-3 fat that we talk about a lot in conjunction with seafood, increasing our intake of DHA as well as some other nutrients, we think is part of the reason why our brains expanded and why we ended up being the species that we are. And you know, some people argue that we didn't necessarily need meat or were not adapted to meat. But if you look at something like our guts, for example, our guts look much more like, or are much closer to something like a carnivore's guts, because they're designed to absorb nutrients directly from the food. So fat and protein directly from the food, rather than something like a chimpanzee's gut or a gorilla's gut or even a cow's gut, which is designed to allow bacteria to ferment all that indigestible plant fiber and then turn it into fat. So our gut looks like a gut that's designed to absorb fat directly from the diet, and we'd only get that mainly from eating animals. Back in the Paleolithic era, some computer models suggest that we probably ate around 500 milligrams per day of EPA and DHA. Those are the two omega-3s that we get from animal sources or from seafood. And so that's definitely an essential component of our evolution. But some people have argued that this would have been much easier if we came from a shore-based population, so people that had access to some fish, bivalves like mussels or oysters or clams, and sea vegetables. So nowadays we talk about things like nori or kelp or wakame or kombu. If we had those in our diet, that would dramatically increase our access to something like DHA, but would also increase our access to things like iodine. So iodine is an essential nutrient, particularly for something like thyroid function, and it's almost impossible to get a consistent source of iodine from anything other than a sea-based life form, be that either animal or vegetable. So there's definitely evidence that we definitely developed at least some of our requirements from things that we can get from seafood. And then if we go to something like, this is just anecdotal evidence, but something like Weston A. Price, I know that when he went looking for traditional cultures and he looked at where they might get something like their DHA from, those cultures that didn't live close to the shore were actually much more likely to go and eat the people that did have access to the shore. So they were actually cannibals, and that was probably because those people had, you know, they had iodine and DHA readily available, particularly in their brains. So I think there, you know, nobody has definitively said that we needed seafood for our evolution, but I think there's some good clues that it was potentially part of it.
I actually read something really interesting as well about the work of Weston Price that most of the traditional societies he visited did really highly value seafood and would travel really great distances to get seafood if they could. And they particularly valued a lot of the time dried fish eggs, mm-hmm. which they would trade with people. So even if they didn't live near the shore, but they would then travel and trade for these fish eggs. And another sort of paper I looked up where they did an analysis of the DHA and EPA in different sources of things like fish eggs and oily fish. Fish eggs are way higher in omega-3 than even fish is. So that's interesting. And the other thing as well is that he found that even when people didn't eat, if they didn't have access to seafood, they often ate a lot of insects.
Yep.
And insects are also really high in EPA and DHA as well. So if they weren't eating seafood, they were often eating insects and still getting those fats.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, people may not realize that once you take away the water in the brain, what's left is mostly fat. And, you know, up to 20% of that is DHA. So that's, you know, it's an incredibly important nutrient. And it tends to sit around the synapses, so the points where nerves communicate with each other. So, you know, part of our complex memory and thought systems, we think, are because we get so much DHA into our brain, and it can help generate synapses. And that's why it's very important for brain development as well as brain evolution.
Okay. So apart from like the evolutionary side of it, is there evidence sort of from modern studies that people who eat more fish or seafood live longer or have lower rates of disease than those who eat less?
So I think overall, absolutely. In you know, when we talk about the problem with most of the data that we have, and it same comes to things like meat consumption, is most of this is observational data, which like we mentioned before, that you can't prove anything with observational data. So if I look at a million people and those that eat the most fish live the longest, that is not proof that fish is necessarily beneficial or healthy. But if you look at sort of overall patterns, I think that fish eaters do tend to see a real benefit. And unlike the controversy with meat, particularly red meat, I think fish, you know, overall has really shown great benefit. In the EPIC study, which is the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer, they have, you know, it's one of the biggest observational studies locally in Europe, which is looking at nutrition and disease. And in those that eat the most fatty fish, they saw a lower risk of type 2 diabetes. Eating more fish has, in many studies, been shown to reduce the risk of colorectal cancer. One analysis showed a 17% reduction in total mortality in those who eat at least two servings of fish per week. A serving is about 150 grams. In general, increasing fish consumption has been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. But some of the controversy comes in because when they then tried to supplement people with fish oil, they don't necessarily see as much of the benefit. So the benefit is definitely coming from fish, but when you then use fish oil, we maybe don't see as much benefit. In the Health Professionals Follow-Up and Nurses Health Studies, so those are big observational studies over in the US, two servings of fish per week reduces the risk of heart disease. And when we're talking about the amount, this is about 4 to 6 grams per week of DHA and EPA from those two servings, say if you ate something like salmon, and that's about 60% EPA and 40% DHA. And then there was a study that came out just this week from the Mega Remodel trial, the Omega Remodel trial, and they gave people 4 grams of pharmaceutical grade, so this is GlaxoSmithKline's patented omega-3 mixture. I don't know what's special about it. I looked it up. It's just EPA and DHA as far as I can tell. But they gave 4 grams per day of people to that after heart attacks, and they saw some improvement in cardiovascular function after heart attacks, which is one of the risks of long-term after heart attacks. So, I mean, overall, whether you're looking at trial data or observational data, I think there's a real benefit for people who eat more fish. So absolutely.
Okay. So one of the things that you see quite a lot is that according to, you just see it on sort of a lot of websites and things, chia seeds are the new superfood that we all need to be eating. Uh-huh. And chia seeds contain 8 times more omega-3 than salmon does. And so I think that is actually true. I think I went to the USDA database and checked it, and it is actually true. They do contain 8 times as much omega-3. So why do we not just all eat chia seeds?
That's a good question. And we could, you know, absolutely. If you like chia seeds, I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with eating chia seeds. They could be, you know, something you can add to your diet. Some people who have gut issues don't. You know, they sort of make this gum when you add them to some kind of fluid, and some people think that irritates the lining of the gut in people that have gut issues, so maybe that's not a good option for them. But the real reason is that the omega-3 that's in chia seeds is alpha-linolenic acid, which is an 18-carbon chain, so that's the length of the carbon in the fat, so it's 18 carbons. DHA is 22, and so what happens if you want to turn alpha-linolenic acid into DHA is you need to make that fat longer. And so you need to metabolize that fat to make it into DHA. And so only about 5% of alpha-linolenic acid is converted to EPA. And then that's along the way to DHA. And then only about 0.5% is converted to DHA. So actually, if you're talking about the omega-3 fat that you need for the brain. So DHA is selectively taken up into the brain. In babies, they only accumulate DHA and arachidonic acid, which is an omega-6 fat. Only those two fats as polyunsaturated fats are accumulated in baby fat because those are the essential fats. So when you're looking at the fat that you really need for the brain and brain development, then that omega-3 is probably not going to be enough. And interestingly, if you're looking at the metabolic pathways that create DHA from ALA, you also need iron, zinc, B6, and magnesium. And if you're looking at best sources of iron, zinc, and B6, again, those are animal products, so meat and fish. So in general, it's thought that ALA is not a good substitute for DHA because the DHA we produce, from ALA, may not be the best version for the brain, and we'll talk a bit about that later, about the exact structure of the DHA. However, if you do blood samples from vegetarians and vegans, they do have less DHA, but they're not as often as we'd expect them to be. They're deficient in DHA, and I think part of the disconnect there is the fact that if you don't take in any DHA, you will upregulate those pathways that create it because it's so essential. But then an argument against that would be that when you make DHA yourself, it may not be in the most ideal form, and actually a more bioavailable and a more useful form would actually come from what you'd get in the diet. So I think overall it would be better to get naturally occurring DHA from the diet rather than forcing your body to make it itself.
And it's important as you get older to have DHA as well, isn't it? Because some studies have linked it with degenerative disease.
Oh, absolutely.
Like low levels.
Yeah, so particularly in the brain, you know, low DHA is associated with so many neurodegenerative diseases. So if you're deficient in DHA while you're in the womb or while you're growing up, then that has a number of problems in terms of your own like cognitive development. You have a lower IQ, you have lower motor coordination as a baby, and then when you grow up, and then when you get older, DHA deficiency is associated with dementia, but also things like Parkinson's, potentially multiple sclerosis, ALS, so motor neuron disease. All of these, you know, the nerves are so dependent on DHA that having a low DHA status is, you know, really thought to be one of the reasons why we get so many neurodegenerative disorders. I mean, they're very complex and there's lots of other things going on, but a low DHA is certainly potentially part of that.
Okay. It's crazy, really, that we're not told more to eat fish, because I know there is like an emphasis in sort of dietary guidelines that we should include some fish, but they don't emphasize it that much, and it's never really sort of explained kind of what the benefits are. But I guess that's the same with all the sort of dietary guidelines.
Well, that's the thing, is I can kind of, it's strange that, because people very vehemently say, you know, remove saturated fat from the diet because that's going to give you heart disease, but nobody says, you know, eat loads of fish because that will, you know, reduce your risk of heart disease. So people are much more, they focus a lot more on what they think is bad rather than what they think is good. I think that's just human nature in general. Yeah. So I think that's potentially why.
Okay, so we've talked about the omega-3, but what other nutrients do we get from fish and seafood other than omega-3? Is there anything else that's beneficial?
We talked about iodine particularly. So iodine is very hard to get from anything other than a sea-based source. So particularly rich in shellfish, so both crab and lobster and things like that, and like mussels and oysters. Vitamin D, so vegetarians and vegans usually have a lower intake of vitamin D, but if they are pescatarians, then that seems to improve. So vitamin D is a good source. And then a lot of minerals, so iron, copper, selenium, zinc. And they're also, again, big in shellfish. Selenium you find a lot of in things like tuna and sardines and salmon as well.
Okay. So one of the reasons that a lot of people say they avoid fish or they're worried about fish is mercury. And you kind of just hear the whole time that mercury is a big problem. I did read somewhere about this selenium health benefit value, which sort of offsets the mercury problem. So can you just explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, so there's some naturally occurring mercury that ends up in the sea. There's also obviously lots of pollutants and various things we do with mercury that have ended up in the sea. And mercury is particularly accumulated in the muscles of larger fish. So we often think about being at the top of the food chain, so things like tuna and swordfish. Probably shark are some of the worst offenders, but actually in things like shellfish, octopus, mussels, oysters, clams, things like that, there's actually much less mercury. So it tends to be, we tend to focus on the mercury in bigger fish. However, a lot of the, you know, one of the things, you know, we talk about two sort of main toxins that are potentially in fish. So mercury is one, methyl mercury is often the form that we see in fish, but also things like polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, and dioxins, which is basically organic molecules that can act as both, you know, neurotoxins and endocrine disruptors and things like that. And most of that tended to come from what we were actually feeding the farmed fish. And most of these studies were done about 10 years ago, and a lot of this was actually found in the food that they were throwing into the water. However, since this kind of came to light, they've made a big effort to change what they've been feeding farmed fish. And actually, so a recent study on Norwegian Atlantic farmed salmon showed that over the last 10 years, the level of dioxins and PCBs have more than halved. The mercury level is almost halved. So now, actually, we think that those levels, you know, you could eat well over a kilo of farmed fish a week, and you wouldn't get anywhere near what we think would be a dangerous level of the PCBs and dioxins. And it's much, much more for the mercury dose. It's, you know, 5 or 6 kilos a week before we think they're, you know, a problematic mercury dose. And one thing that people often talk about is that, you know, so mercury is a neurotoxin, and you know, in reality, any mercury is too much mercury. But, you know, unfortunately, the world we live in, there's just this stuff is everywhere. So they've done some really nice studies in the Seychelles looking at DHA intake and mercury and development in kids. So this is during pregnancy, and what they did is they take the mums. They measure omega-6s and omega-3s in the blood, and then they measure mercury in the hair. So they get some, you know, this is not just people telling you what they've eaten. We're actually looking at, you know, real physiological data. And what they see is that mums who have a greater DHA intake, their babies have better developmental outcomes, so better cognitive outcomes. Interestingly, if they have a higher omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, so too much omega-6, not enough omega-3, that worsens neurodevelopmental outcome, probably because those babies aren't getting enough DHA. And if you have more mercury, obviously that is found to be detrimental, but if you've got a good DHA intake, then that overcomes, that appears to overcome the mercury problem and is still beneficial. So on some level, DHA is protective against mercury in terms of baby development. And, you know, they've done a number of studies where they give DHA to mums and they think they see improved outcomes in the babies. And interestingly, so selenium, obviously, there's selenium is another mineral that you find a lot of, particularly in seafood. And again, it's big fish and shellfish, or things like mussels and oysters and that kind of stuff. And so if the effect that mercury has on the mitochondria, the function of the mitochondria, is directly, and this is mainly in the test tube, but we've seen it in a number of studies as well, but if you're looking at just mitochondrial function in the test tube, the effect of mercury is counteracted by selenium, but also counteracted by upregulating a pathway associated with something called NRF2. And people don't need to know what that means, but that's basically something that's upregulated in other states which we think is beneficial, like ketosis or eating lots of sulfurous vegetables like cabbage and things like that, because the isothiocyanates increase NRF2. So mercury is a problem, but, you know, I kind of think that if you eat more shellfish, mussels and oysters, you know, you sort of...
and the fish smaller down the food chain, yes, like sardines, yeah, and things like that.
And interestingly, sardines, mackerel, salmon all have a very similar mercury content. So it's actually maybe just the top of this food chain, so something like tuna is the worst, and then the rest are about the same. Okay. So, you know, sardines have a similar mercury content to salmon. But you focus on those. You reduce your omega-6, you know, if you're having a baby and you're worried about, you know, brain development, and already anybody who's worrying about stuff this much, I think, is giving a great head start, so I really don't want people to worry about it too much. We definitely think that the benefits outweigh the negative side effects of the mercury. And if you are eating a lot of fish, and you're worried about it, then maybe you take a DHA supplement, and that sort of gives you a bit of an insurance policy.
With the selenium thing, though, doesn't the selenium bind to the mercury so that you don't actually absorb the mercury if the selenium's higher, or is that not?
It can compete with where the mercury is causing a problem, but if it's already in there, so if you're taking them together at the same time, then absolutely. So it could have multiple protective effects.
Okay. And the other
selenium can also protect against radiation. Radiation toxicity or radiation poisoning. So, you know,
because that was the other thing I was going to ask about, because that's the other thing that you read about fish. It's the mercury content and then it's radiation, and obviously with like nuclear disasters and things, people are becoming increasingly concerned, and you see some reports obviously saying it isn't anything to worry about, but obviously that's something people are always going to feel concerned about.
So, I mean, so particularly I think what people are talking about is Fukushima, aren't they, because that's you know, is on right on the coast, close to these huge fishing areas, and one of the things they particularly were worried about was a radioactive metal, or a radioactive version of a metal, cesium, and it has a long half life, and they know they will have lost some into the ocean in 2011 when Fukushima, you know, went wrong, yeah. And they've done a number of studies, particularly on the west coast of America, so the Pacific Northwest, up near Oregon and Washington states, and then also up in Canada, and actually the levels of radioactive cesium in the fish are still below detectable levels, so they haven't seen an increase there. And then some Japanese scientists have done and did an analysis of what they thought would be an increased risk to the fishermen in Japan. So these are the guys who are handling the fish day in, day out. And they thought that the extra radiation that had been dumped into the sea and would then end up in the fish would cause an extra 2 cancer deaths per 10 million people. So they might not actually even ever see those deaths. You know, it's that small. And so the extra total lifetime dose of radiation they did in this calculation to people who were eating fish or eating these fish from this area, it was, they said 0.9 to 5.7 microsieverts. And sievert is just basically a measure of radiation. And so that is about a quarter of what you'd get from a transatlantic flight. So, you know, it's compared, you know, if you ever fly anywhere, that's more radiation than you get from eating, you know, radioactive fish from Japan. And I actually had a really nice anecdote around the time, which is that when this went off, people, you know, British citizens within a certain circumference or a certain number of kilometers from the power plant in Fukushima, they were evacuated by the British consulate in Japan. And by flying them back to the UK, they exposed them to more radiation than they would have been exposed to if they'd have just stayed in Fukushima. So I think overall it's probably not something worth worrying about.
Okay. So we've touched on wild versus farmed fish a little bit before. So would you always recommend wild over farmed fish? And if yes, is farmed fish still better than no fish from a health point of view? There's obviously the sustainability point of view as well, which I do understand that some people are really anti-farmed fish because the feed, like you said, the things they're fed, and also the amount, I think the amount of fish that go into feeding farmed fish is not very sustainable. But if you're just looking from a health point of view.
Yeah, well, I mean, I also think that most of the data that people are quoting on farmed fish is actually quite old. It's at least 10 years old, and they've gone to a lot of steps to try and improve this. And I'm not saying it's ideal, but it's definitely been improved. So I read recently that Norwegian companies farming fish in Canada have like imported some salmon viruses that are now like killing out the traditional salmon population in the west coast of Canada. I haven't seen any robust data for that, but that's kind of floating out there on the internet. But in general, actually, I don't think there's any reason to suggest that you have to go wild over farmed. And I do understand why people would rather go for wild. It's usually line caught. You know, it does have a lower risk of disease. It's just been eating what it's, you know, supposed to eat. So in general, wild salmon does have lower mercury content. It does have lower PCB and dioxin content and other toxins. But it's not that much lower, and it's not so much lower that you would say that farmed salmon isn't worth it. So people generally talk about salmon when they're talking about this data, because that's where most of the study is done, and most, you know, we have to do a lot of farmed salmon in the US and in Europe, and obviously we have a good comparison of wild salmon. So some studies done about 10 years ago found that Scottish salmon was the most toxin laden, so it had most mercury, most dioxins, most PCBs. Again, this is 10 years ago, so I don't know where that's at now. Like I said, in the Norwegian populations, that's improved dramatically in the last 10 years. And then, you know, compared to the Norwegian salmon, farmed salmon from the Atlantic or from Norway or anywhere in the Pacific, that was better in terms of toxin content. Like I said, wild is best. It's interesting to note that anything that says it's Alaskan salmon, it can't be farmed, so it has to be wild. So they have lower toxin content, but if you look at farmed salmon, it tends to have a higher EPA and DHA content, so it's a higher omega-3 content. And so I think overall, the two are potentially pretty equal. And again, you see more omega-3s in the colder fish, so those coming from places like Norway or the Atlantic Ocean versus something like the Pacific Ocean on the west coast of the US.
So if someone was vegetarian or vegan, again, we've touched a little bit on why sort of DHA is really important. And if someone was avoiding fish for health reasons, not for ethical reasons, because obviously if you're avoiding fish for ethical reasons, that's a completely different thing. But if you're avoiding fish because you think for health reasons it's better, and you do always just see that written on websites, do you think there really is any good reason to do that or not?
I certainly haven't seen it. All the data points towards a benefit of eating seafood, even, you know, despite even despite the potential toxin levels. And you know, the, you know, it's just a sad fact of life, like I was saying, that there's toxins in everything we eat.
Everything.
So if you're talking about things like PCBs and dioxins, again, which is what people tend to focus on, obviously because people eat the most of these compared to something like seafood, the, you know, most of, you know, so about a third of them in the diet come from other meat products like beef, pork and chicken. Dairy products give about a third. Vegetables give over 20%. And fish and shellfish are much lower down the list. So, you know, people who are avoiding fish but eating a lot of anything else, you know, they're still going to
be getting,
you know, it. So there's little evidence to suggest that they'll be getting a lower overall toxin dose.
And Denise Minger talks about if people are really vegan for ethical reasons and can't, you know, just don't want to eat fish or anything like that, that they could perhaps consider eating bivalve just because yeah. they're non-sentient and they will provide a huge range of nutrients that they won't be getting otherwise.
Yeah.
So what kind of, can you just explain a bit more about that? What kind of things should people maybe consider eating?
Yeah, so I mean, if people are worried about, you know, it kind of depends on where, what it is you're worried about. You know, some people will just have, you know, no animal products for ethical reasons, and that's absolutely their choice. But, you know, I do understand Denise Minger's point, which is kind of bivalves are sort of in between, if you see what I mean. They're not, you know, they obviously do have a nervous system, so they will have some kind of, you know, they are sentient in as such as they can sense their environment, but then again, so can plants. So it kind of depends on where you lie with that. But, you know, things like oysters or mussels or clams, you know, iodine, iron, zinc, DHA, that you're going to get them in a form that's much more bioavailable than you get from plant foods. And they really are essential for things like brain function, iodine for thyroid function. And what I was talking about earlier in terms of DHA coming from seafood, what we know, or what we're starting to find out now, is that the structure that we get DHA in from seafood is probably in the ideal position. So if you have the way that fats are transported and stored in the body, they come in things called triglycerides, which we mentioned earlier, and it's basically three fat chains attached to a glycerol molecule. If you have, in fish, naturally, it comes in what we call the SN2 position. So basically, you have three fats, and then the DHA is in the middle, in position number two. And in this position, it's more bioavailable, so you absorb it more easily. It's much more likely to be transported across the brain, so across the blood-brain barrier. We need DHA in that position to get across the blood-brain barrier. And in this position, it's almost protected, so it's less likely to be oxidized. And so for all of these reasons, the DHA in seafood is really the ideal DHA that in order for us to best use it. You know, it gets incorporated into mitochondria better, which is where we need a lot of our DHA for proper mitochondrial function. So I think if people are worried about eating fish for certain reasons, but maybe they're less worried about something like a clam or a mussel or an oyster, then eating some of those, you know, does have some real potential benefit.
Okay, and what types of fish or seafood would you recommend people focus on? Because you're always, like you said, most of the studies are done on salmon, and you're always hearing that we should eat salmon, but there's so many other varieties of things out there. And even when I just said I was looking at something about the levels of EPA and DHA, and it was saying that fish eggs are far higher in those two things, actually, than a lot of fish. But you never really see recommendations to eat fish eggs, but I don't know why, because obviously caviar is expensive, but other types of roe are not expensive.
Yeah, I mean, other types of fish roe are really, really cheap. And it's so obviously I'm in Norway at the moment, and it's a really, really popular thing to spread on bread or whatever. And so it has a very, very high omega-3 content, but they're also a great source of things like vitamin D, vitamin E. People talk a lot about it, about fish eggs being a good source of vitamin K2. I haven't seen any exact studies where they've measured that, and it kind of, like, people talk about they think that vitamin K2 is high in fish eggs. So very possible that, you know, and that goes along, and a lot of it comes from the Weston A. Price line of thinking, whereas these you know, vitamin K2 containing foods were some of the most highly prized foods, and fish eggs were one of the most highly prized foods. But I haven't yet seen a study there, so people think that fish eggs are high in K2, which obviously is very beneficial for cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis risk and things like that. But other than that, you know, I think people should just focus on what they enjoy and what they can afford. So, you know, if you're pregnant, then maybe you steer away from things like tuna. You know, get a good balance. You know, I think you should go for some kind of sustainably fished fish. So, you know, some farmed salmon is, you know, very sustainably grown. You know, but then smaller fish. You can get some more omega-3 fats and other things. So if you're eating things like mackerels or sardines from a tin, but you don't eat dairy products, then some of the bones and stuff are in there. That gives you a good source of calcium. And people often shy away from things like mussels and clams and oysters. But, you know, in terms of the nutrition that they provide versus the potential negative effects, they really are, you know, where the money is. So mussels, oysters, clams, you know, loads and loads of nutrients and a lower sort of toxin content. So if people are worried about the balance there, then maybe they should focus on those.
What about something like prawns, which are obviously eaten quite a lot? Are they
good, bad?
Prawns
are great, and along the lines of shellfish, they kind of, you know, those kind of crustaceans are very similar in nutrient content. And we used to be told not to eat prawns because of the high cholesterol content. But, you know, we don't worry about that anymore.
So. No, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so the last couple of questions were about fish oil and cod liver oil and stuff. So that almost could be a whole podcast in itself. Yeah. So I've read so many articles online about fish oils and cod liver oil and stuff. But is there any benefit in taking fish oil supplements, particularly for people that don't eat much fish? So I'm interested in this because my daughter, she's only 3. I can't get her to eat fish.
Yeah.
She just won't eat it. My son's only 18 months and I've given him loads of fish and he eats it all the time. But for her, I can't get her to eat fish at the moment. Is there any benefit to taking fish oil supplements or cod liver oil?
Yeah, so I think absolutely. And one of the studies I didn't mention earlier, they were looking at omega, you know, we talk about omega-3 and omega-6 balance. And I know some people think that if you just reduce omega-6, then your omega-3 intake matters less. But some studies suggest that something like your cardiovascular risk, heart disease risk, is reduced by omega-3s regardless of what your omega-6 intake is. So I think there's a real potential benefit there, particularly for people who don't eat fish. But one thing that I think people need to take into account is that the difference in the quality of the products that you're taking is going to vary hugely. And they've done a number of studies just looking at the quality of fish oil and it never, you know, and what they contain, and they never contain quite what they say in terms of fatty acid content, or, you know, they've got more oxidized fats or whatever. And because these fats are very susceptible to processing. So if you process in fish oil, you know, I talked about the SN2 position of DHA. In fish oil, that often seems to flip and it ends up in the SN1 position. So it's actually the less bioavailable, less useful form. And that tends to happen, you know, it's almost a naturally occurring reaction when fish oil is heated up. So the more you process it, I think the less potential benefit you might get. And I think that's part of the reason why, I mean, obviously you're not getting all the other nutrients that you get from seafood, but I think that's part of the reason why we don't necessarily see a benefit in trials where they've given people omega-3s, because they just give these, you know, highly processed fish oils that are stuck in a capsule and kept in, you know, they're kept in a cupboard at whatever temperature and all of that. So I think if you can get minimally processed fish oil or something like krill oil, again, if this is somebody who isn't a big fan of eating fish and would rather get it from sort of like a less sentient source, then something like a cold pressed fish oil potentially is minimally processed. And again, I think something like cod liver oil or a whole liver sort of or a whole fish oil, something like, especially a cod liver oil, because that's just the most studied, what people use the most, I think is better than a highly processed omega-3 oil or fish oil because of the naturally occurring antioxidants like vitamin E. So we think that having the vitamin E naturally present in the oil will prevent some of the damage that can happen to fats when you process them. So that's why I think in general, if you're looking at fish oil versus omega-3 versus cod liver oil, then I think cod liver oil is probably the best.
And cod liver oil did used to be not prescribed, but like recommended by doctors, and you know, sort of we were told in the UK, take cod liver oil.
Yeah.
And my parents and grandparents, they all remember being given this awful tasting cod liver oil. God knows whether it was rancid or not, I don't know, but they were kind of forced to take it, and people really, really remember those days. And obviously that doesn't happen now, but cod liver oil must have a good history with safety and results and all that kind of stuff, because it has been used for so many years.
Absolutely. My grandparents, you know, my grandma has told me a number of times, she's Icelandic and she grew up on a farm in Iceland, and you know, every day you got your tablespoon of cod liver oil, whether you liked it or not. You know, this is something that's been a huge part of the culture, and you know, and I can't say that it's purely down to the cod liver oil, but the, you know, Iceland has some of the longest living people in the world, so you know, they're definitely doing something right, and maybe part of that is kind of the culture of fish and of cod liver oil.
And so the fermented cod liver oil is the one that you are told to take. You sort of see that the Western Price recommend that as the best one to take is fermented cod liver oil.
Yeah.
And they say they have concerns about normal cod liver oil because it might be rancid or whatever else. And I just wondered if there's any evidence that that is better. And is that the recommendation you would give to people, is to get a fermented one if they can, or do you think normal cod liver oil is okay?
So I haven't seen any studies on fermented cod liver oil versus normal cod liver oil. I don't think there's anything that people have looked into. I think one thing they talk about is that obviously if you get any bacterial fermentation, you increase things like vitamin K2. So I think that's one of the potential reasons they say that fermented is better. But I find it very strange that they say that you should have fermented cod liver oil, but not normal cod liver oil, because normal cod liver oil might be rancid. But the process of fermenting fats makes them rancid. So I imagine the fats being in fermented cod liver oil being more rancid, and you're having less of the DHA in the structure that you'd ideally want it. So I'd actually just on, you know, basic biochemistry, disagree with that and say that probably just normal, minimally processed cod liver oil from a good source is just as good. Again, I haven't seen these studies. Nobody's compared these in any trials or anything. But just from like a theoretical standpoint, I'd say normal cod liver oil is fine, and that's what I'd suggest people take.
And also, cod liver oil, as opposed to fish oil, does have vitamins A and D, which fish oil never really has.
Yep.
And that is another reason why people were told to take it, because especially in places like Iceland, vitamin D levels maybe not going to be, you're not going to be getting much from the sun. And the same in the UK, and especially all through the winter, we're not getting much vitamin D. That's one reason to take cod liver oil over fish oil, isn't it? Because fish oil won't have those vitamins on the whole.
No, absolutely. And I recently, so again, talk about my grandmother. I'm sure she won't mind me mentioning that I recently looked at some blood test results from her, and I looked at her vitamin D level, and she eats a lot of fish. She has a small amount of cod liver oil every day, and her vitamin D level was 90, you know, in the winter in Iceland. So, you know, I think that's a really good potential source of vitamin D if people aren't getting a lot of sunshine or something.
Okay, well, that were all my questions, so.
Great. Have we, like, we're well under an hour there. People are going to be ecstatic.
It's one of those topics, though. It's so specific. I guess you can't waffle on too long about it.
Okay, perfect. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Just a reminder, any questions always can come, like, through iTunes or through my website, which is drragnar.com, drragnar.com, or Chloe's website, paleo-britain.co.uk. We always love to hear from people, information, studies, things that we hadn't read before, or thoughts, and we'll be back soon.
Okay, thanks for listening.
Thanks, Chloe.
Bye.
Bye.